Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June the 4th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Tom Perry. His subject, the Chelans, Chiefs, Miners, and the Cavalry. Let's listen in.
However, things started to get stirred up in the 1850s, when gold was discovered north of here, up in the Colville area, up in this part of Washington, and further north in the Fraser River area in British Columbia. And what happened was, down in California, I mean, why is it this always happens? Migration comes up from California. The people who are playing out their claims in the California gold rush heard about all the gold up north. And one of the favorite routes was up to the Columbia River and then up the river into gold country. And so in the 1850s, miners started moving up here. And it was miners in particular that got into a lot of trouble with the local native people. They resented all of these groups, and because this was Indian country, miners would travel in big groups, 100, 150 at a time. And the local natives resented them. They felt like they were poaching, hunting their game. Where miners did set up camp and start doing some prospecting, they messed up the rivers. And for salmon people, this was just infuriating, that they would put up these sluice boxes, put all this sludge into the rivers. So they did not like miners from the word go. The miners didn't particularly like the natives either. They were constantly complaining to the military that they were impeding their progress or wrecking their sluice boxes or kicking them out of valleys or whatever. And they were, so there was bad blood between miners and natives from the beginning in the 1850s. And there's another factor that most people don't realize, and that is a racial factor. In the 1850s, a lot of the people who were brought from China to work on the railroads down in California, as soon as they could, they would stop working for the railroad, which was one of the worst jobs you could have, and they'd go off, try their luck mining. Well, a lot of them came through this region. In fact, the 1870 census found that there were 300 Chinese miners in the Wenatchee Valley. And by 1879, there were 500 to 700 down here on the Middle Columbia. So there were quite a number of Chinese miners in this region, and for a long time, they far outnumbered the white settlers. And in some areas, they outnumbered even the natives. Down across the Columbia River, from Chelan, there was a Chinese store. A Chinese miner had stopped there. He set up a trading post, and he supplied many of the Chinese miners moving up and down here. Now, eventually, this started in the 1850s, eventually this led to one of the worst confrontations in the in this area, when in 1875, Yinamositsa, who was the chief of the Chelans until he died in 1882, decided he was going to clean out the area of Chinese miners. And this all goes back to a confrontation that happened in the 1850s when they first encountered Chinese miners. One of the chiefs further up the valley had some scouts out looking around, and they discovered two Chinese miners working a claim. Well, they brought them into the chief and said, "Look what we found. Who are these people?" And so the chief called a big council, And they got all the chiefs and the medicine men together, and they kept these miners in the village, and they couldn't talk to them. They couldn't figure out who they were. They'd never heard of them, and they'd seen white people before. They concluded after a couple of days' discussion they weren't white people, and they weren't native people. And then, as these things go, a medicine man got up, made a speech, concluding on some religious or, well, many times what their conclusions were based on these dreams. They were dreamers. The medicine men, all of their visions came to them in dreams. He concluded that these were devils. And this was what caused a great deal of bad blood from then on, because this medicine man with, you know, religious authority decided these were devils, and so they were not good people. So in 1875, Unamasitsa, chief of the Chelans, decided he was going to lead a war party and clean out these four valleys from of Chinese miners. Well, word got out that there was a war party after them, and so all the Chinese miners, about 300 of them, took off in a group. They just sort of, the word passed, and they took off and tried to hide. And they ended up hiding up in the hills around Chelan itself on one of the benches overlooking the river. Well, eventually the Chelans found them, surrounded them, and did them all in, 300 of them. It's one of the worst massacres in Washington, and it's pretty much unrecorded, because as far as the military was concerned, it was not of much concern, because they were Chinese. Chinese immigration stopped in 1882 or 3 when the government passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which made it illegal to bring Chinese workers into the country anymore. Still, in through the 1880s, although that massacre was pretty effective in discouraging the Chinese from coming through this area, they nonetheless came back by the 1880s, and there were still quite a number of them working claims up and down in this area. And there are stories of confrontations even then between natives and miners. One of the Entiat chief's relatives, who was known as Crooked Mouth Bob, which apparently came from a barroom brawl in Leavenworth between him and a Chinese miner, and the miner happened to have a pickaxe with him, and rearranged his mouth for him. So that's kind of what was going on here. By the mid-1850s, there were groups of miners streaming through to go to the north, a lot of Chinese miners in the area. There were the odd prospectors combing the hills, looking for claims. They were working the rivers with placer developments and so forth. By then, the territorial government decided it's time to start having some councils with these native people and work out some deals. And so, in 1855, the military called all the chiefs in this region, the Meathows, the Chelans, the Entiats, and the Wenatchees, as well as the Columbias, who are the big group of Middle Columbia Salish over here, called them all down here to Priest Rapids, or sorry, no, the 1855 council was actually over here in Walla Walla. And discussed the whole area of who was entitled to do what where. And of course, the government had in mind creating a reservation. And what they had in mind was creating what is now the Yakima Reservation down here. It went on for several days. The chief of the Yakimas himself was quite opposed to the idea. And eventually, Stevens, the governor, told the military, go in and threaten him that if he doesn't comply, we will just wipe out his people. So there was no, diplomacy lasted a couple of days at this council before brute force was employed. And so He relented, and they created the Yakima Reservation. Now, what the government had in mind is something the Indian population did not understand, of course, that this Yakima Reservation would eventually be where everybody who was a native person lived. They did get two concessions out of this treaty. Aside from the Yakima Reservation, the Celilo Falls fishery would be reserved for them, as well as the area around Leavenworth, where they had their other fishery. The Wenatchees, who were at the council, absolutely insisted on this because that was their livelihood, basically. The Wenatchees, the Entiats, signed. The Chelans didn't. This is typical. This fellow Yenemasitza that I talked about, what considered himself quite the warrior. His name means rainbow robe. He was quite flamboyant, apparently. And as far as I know, he never signed anything with the government. He basically told them every time they came to him to go buzz off. So Lake Chelan was, as far as the native people who lived there on the shores of what is now Manson and Chelan, was not included in any sort of deal with the government yet. Now, this treaty, which created the Yakima Reservation, reserved the fisheries, lasted about a year before there was trouble. This is fairly typical of treaties between native councils and the government in this time. It didn't take long because the government really didn't have much control over what settlers were doing, and basically they were just reacting. People would go into an area after it was open for settlement, because once there was a treaty, that meant that it was officially open for settlement. People could go there and establish settlements. Settlement didn't come to the Chelan area for some time, but people began moving up the Columbia and establishing businesses, trading posts, small villages, so forth. But in 1856, what they call the Yakima War erupted. Down around here, the Yakimas themselves, this chief who was not particularly happy about having the Yakima Reservation forced down his throat, decided a year later that he was going to do something about it. And in 1856, the army took a very serious defeat around Toppenish down here. But by spring of the next year, they had pretty much defeated the natives of that area. Some of the Middle Columbia groups, the Columbias and the Chelans, perhaps sent people down because that was typical. They would fight as regional groups rather than particular tribes. So they would send off, usually the chiefs were interrelated anyway. They were cousins of some kind or another. They used arranged marriages to forge alliances with the surrounding groups. And so a chief from one of these Columbia groups might go down to this area to look for a wife. And they could, since they were polygamous, they could have several alliances depending on where they got various of their wives. But the problems, of course, were, again, while this was a reserve, it looked like the government was reneging because they weren't keeping the miners out. The miners kept tromping through reserve lands, setting up mining operations and, you know, not asking permission and so forth. And this really peeved the natives. Again, it was the miners who were the principal culprits. In 1858, in fact, our Chelan chief here at Yenemasitza received a group of about 150 miners on their way north. was extremely generous to them, brought them into the village, fed them salmon, told them how to get further north, told them just the route to take, and it turns out he was setting up an ambush. He had sent them down a blind canyon, and by the time they got up there, he and the meat house and some of the Okanagans from up here were waiting in the blind canyon. However, some of the braves didn't hold discipline, and there were some early arrows, and the miners realized they were heading into a trap, and they escaped. I think they only lost about 6 people in the skirmish, but that was the sort of thing that was going on at that time. It wasn't all-out war, but there were a lot of skirmishes. So the government, through the 1860s, was pretty much ignoring what was going on out here because of the Civil War. In the early 1870s, though, the miners came back. Mining went down also during the Civil War. So the miners came back, the military came back, and there was more interest in this area. And the next thing that happens is in 1872, the government tries again with the reservation idea. The Yakima Reservation was established, but so far only the Yakimas were interested in it because it was their ancestral territory. So they went up here to the Colville region and established the Colville Reservation up here with some of the native groups up here who are not Salish. So the Colvilles, the San Pauls, and the Nispalums were put into that reservation. It was a rather large reservation. There was plenty of room on it. And of course, again, the government had in mind, perhaps we can entice some of these groups to go up here. Eventually, that's what happened, but it didn't exactly work out the way the government had in mind. That was 1872. By the way, that was also the year of the great earthquake of 1872. If you drove up from Wenatchee, you went past something called Earthquake Point. That's where, for about 24 hours, the Columbia was dammed by all the stuff that fell off that cliff from the earthquake. The Wenatchee sent scouts up the river to look for the reason why the river was suddenly drying up. And they found that the river was dammed there, and that after 24 hours it broke loose and started flowing again. But that's still a very unstable place, and they have lots of little tremblers there, and stuff is always falling off the face of that cliff. The next thing that really was of interest in this area was in 1877, when this big group here, the Columbias, were asked by the government to please move to the Yakima Reservation. By that time, the leader of the Columbias, Quetelitsin, who took the English name Chief Moses, was extremely powerful. Yenemositsa, the Chelan chief, was his cousin. He, in turn, was a cousin of Chief Joseph of the Nez Perces. And in the late 1870s, Joseph was one of the big problems for the military out in this region, because the Nez Perce Wars went on through 1877, 1878. And so Moses was a big operator. He was a potential ally for Chief Joseph, which worried the government. And he was a leader of all of these native groups in this middle Columbia region. So, in about the mid-1870s, they decided they needed to deal with Chief Moses. So that General Howard, who was then the commander of this area, came in and met with Moses and said, Well, you should move to the Yakima Reservation because there's a council in 1855 that set that up. And if you don't move there, then we'll have to banish you. Now, banishment meant in those days going down in here across the Snake River into Idaho and into that country over that way, which the people up here, the Inumasitsa, the Chelans, describe that country as a country a grizzly bear couldn't even live in. They didn't think much of it. For one thing, it was way away from the Salmon River, and they didn't want to live that way. They had experience over there because since about the 1730s or 40s, these people, although they're Salish, had also gone buffalo hunting. Because when they got horses, they were able to go into Montana and hunt buffalo. And so they knew that country over there, because every year they'd take these long treks in the fall to go hunt buffalo. Well, Moses then started being a diplomat. He took his supporting chiefs. They went and talked to the military and said, sure, we'll go to the Yakima Reservation. They all verbally agreed to do that, and then they all went home and did nothing. Just ignored what the government had to say. Now, what Moses did then was kind of like 20th century diplomacy. He established all of his braves into a number of big war camps, and they were in full war gear all the time. I mean, he knew the military would watch them, and the military knew that he had established all these war camps. But he kept sending messages to General Howard, I'm really a man of peace, you know, and I don't want to have any battles, you know, but I do have my cousin Joseph over there in the Nez Perce Wars, and I really should be helping him, you know, blood is thicker than water. So he was really playing the federal government for all it was worth. He figured he had the cards right then, and so he tried to push it. Then in 1878, another war broke out even further to the south and east, the Bannock-Paiute War. So over here in Idaho, they had the Nez Perce Wars, they had the Bannock-Paiute Wars. There were just too many military problems for them to worry about this region. The government decided Chief Moses might be better to deal with than to fight with. The sort of crucial point came when the military decided, or actually it was the Washington militia decided, one last time we'll try to get Moses to move to the Yakima Reservation. So a detachment rode into Moses Coulee where they were all encamped. And they did one of those things like you see in the movies, where the hordes of braves on horses come over the hill in full war paint, do a charge down the hill right at the cavalry, and then they stopped 100 yards short. This is where the Chelan chief got his one sentence or two sentences into the history books. And he said he was sent out by Moses to talk to the military after they had stopped dead in their tracks. And he said, he delivered an ultimatum. He said, me interpreter, Chief Moses wants to talk to you. Moses say, you go back over the river and mind your own business. And they did, since they were badly outnumbered. And it was at that point they decided, I think, you know, the government decided it's time to make a deal with Moses rather than try pushing him any harder. So in September, they set up a council down here, and I've got a red dot here, at Priest Rapids. They came upstream in a steamboat, and that's as far as they could get, and they docked the steamboat, and they had a council with all the chiefs from up here. This time, Moses left his cousin Yenemasitsa, the Chelan, the warlike Chelan chief, at home. He didn't want any carrying on. And instead, he brought one of the brothers of the Entiat chief, Wapato John. Now, Wapato John was an Entiat who'd lived in Fort Vancouver for a while. and learned agriculture. He was the first one to bring apples into the Middle Columbia area. And Wapato means potato in Chinook. He farmed, he ran a trading post, he had a cattle herd, and he traded in horses. So he was a big merchant. He was well known to the white settlers. So he was brought as one of the sub-chiefs at this council because he was well respected. Chief Moses didn't want to put on the warlike face. He wanted to put on the diplomatic face at this point. And he requested a reservation at this meeting, which included this area here, which is the Columbia's traditional territory, east of the Columbia River. General Howard, thought that was a reasonable request, and he immediately closed the Middle Columbia for any further settlement and sent the request to Washington. Now, one thing that happened here, though, was that the Wenatchees realized that this excluded their traditional fisheries down here that they had wanted to keep all along. And so they were cheesed with Moses for doing this. And they didn't want to have much more to do with Moses. They felt a little bit sold out. The next thing that happened in 1878-79 was the government turned down the request for a reservation there. At the same time, there were some renegades, probably Umatillas from further south, who had been coming up in this region and ambushing settlers. And for some reason, word got out, and it was printed in the Tacoma paper that it was Chief Moses and his gangs who were doing that. So in the winter of 1878, on into 79, both Yenemositsa, the Chelan chief from up here, and Moses were arrested and taken down to Fort Simcoe. And it was there while he was in the guardhouse that the Chief Moses found out that the government had turned down his request for a reservation, and apparently it was turned down by the president himself. In the spring of 1879, though, by that time they had figured out it wasn't Moses who was doing this ambushing of the settlers and so forth, and they released him, and at the same time the Bureau of Indian Affairs invited him to Washington to discuss further the matter of where the natives would live. His view on this is very interesting. Some of the things that he had to say in some of the negotiations, he said, "I do not want to make the laws about the land. I do have a request to make for myself and my people." This was in one of the negotiations where he requested a reservation. And he said, "I am a little afraid to speak about the lands. I fear to declare where the homes of my people shall be. The Great Spirit will look after that." He did not like the government's concept of land ownership and demarking and marking out boundaries. And he thought they should be free to move where the Great Spirit took them, which was essentially where the hunting and fishing was. Nonetheless, he went to Washington, and they held the conversations. And this time, the government, the Interior Department, and the Commissioner of Indian Affairs proposed a new reservation. And it included all this territory in here, including both shores of Lake Chelan. If this had held, we would have been in the middle of an Indian reservation right now. So that all this territory, all the way up to Canadian border, west of the Okanagan River, which is this valley here, all the way up to the crest of the Cascades, was to be a new reservation. The Chelans, Yanomusitsa, were delighted. I mean, this was their traditional territory. The only ones who were not happy was it still didn't include the Wenatchee's fishery down here near Leavenworth. So they were still cheesed at Moses. But Moses was able to celebrate this triumphant return. They had a big powwow and a celebration over this new reserve. The only problem was it didn't last a year. There are already in this area up here a whole lot of miners, and it's the miners again. And they began writing furious letters to Washington and to the general about taking away all their mining claims. And so the first thing that happened was the government gave back a 15-mile strip along the Canadian border, took it out of the reserve, and said all the miners in there could stay. The government also moved then to establish Camp Chelan, which was the first settlement there of white people. It was a military post, and it was there to be the office of the new reservation. It was surrounded by the Indian villages that existed there, but it in 1880 it existed there, but in 1881 it was closed already. Government cutbacks. They weren't going to support this reservation after all. They also, at the time, the Entiats who lived down in here were not part of this reservation, so the government moved them up here. It's a very interesting thing. This changed the shape of Lake Chelan because it was no longer just the Chelan people living there, but it was Wapato John, this big Entiat trader, and his family, and all those people who came in, moved in, and built their own villages there because they got moved into what was to be the reservation. So now there are Chelans and Entiats living at the south end of Lake Chelan. Now, what happened next was pretty much a story of how Native people were basically dispossessed of lands that they were supposed to get. The government simply summarily decided to do away with this reservation they had established. What they did was they called Moses back to Washington. So remember, this is all land that is of interest to the folks on the West Bank from the Columbia. Moses is the chief over here. They call Moses back to Washington and they tell him, don't bring these guys. How about you bring Chief Tenasket from the Okanagans up here? So Tenasket and Moses went to Washington. The town of Tenasket, of course, is named after that chief. And they went to Washington, and the government then made a deal with Moses. Basically, they said, forget about that other reservation. You guys all move up here to the Colville Reservation, which already exists. And if you do that, we'll pay you a lot of money. So they gave Moses a big pension and a bunch of cash up front, and he and the Columbias moved up to the northeast into the Colville Reservation, essentially selling out all the people on the West Bank. Yanomusitsa, the Chelan chief, died in 1882, so he wasn't unhappy long, but he was really unhappy about being sold out that way.
What kind of numbers are we talking about with these shifts, like when they went up there? What?
The tribal groups probably were no more than about 500 each. The Chelans had about 300 living at the foot of Lake Chelan in the 1870s. There were more earlier, but their populations went down a great deal between the first contact with white settlers and the 1870s and 80s because of smallpox.
Disease, right?
So, looking at the settlements on Lake Chelan, at one time as many as 1,000 people may have lived there, although it's hard to tell because they used both winter and summer villages. And sometimes they would just decide that there was a better place, and they'd move their winter village. So even if you counted winter lodges, you couldn't be sure that, you know, they were all occupied at the same time. But there may have been as many as 1,000 living there at one time. So they aren't huge groups, but they're... I think that's part of the point, that they were all able to live in this area fairly harmoniously because they were not overpopulating it. And as soon as the numbers went way up, there was competition over property and fishing and hunting rights. And it's very interesting that it was the miners that the natives didn't like. Settlers, as the settlement came on in, they were quite happy with families who moved in and moved and lived near them. It was the miners they didn't like. Even the old chief of the Entiats, Shilkuhasket, who lived to be 112, he was born in 1788, died in 1900. He refused to move when they moved all the Entiats into the Lake Chelan area. He lived down there until 1900. And he's one of the reasons not many people settled up the Entiat Valley, because all he had for people who wanted to come up his valley mostly was a load of buckshot. But that was directed at the miners mostly. The people who settled in what's now the town of Entiat were quite welcomed by him, and they used to tell stories about being invited up to his house a little further up the river. And he'd dance the old dances and tell old stories and stuff for them. But if you were a miner, you just better watch out. The old guy was going to chase you out. So the Columbias took the deal, moved off to the Caldwell Reservation, and left everybody down here high and dry. By that point, in the early 1880s, two things had happened. The Homestead Act had been amended so that Native people could homestead. Before that, they were prevented from it. The other thing that happened, which affected Lake Chelan more, was that the government introduced the Allotment Act, in which every Native family could be allotted a mile square property on their ancestral lands. Or they either do that or go to a reservation. Take your pick. Well, old Yenemosetsa of the Chelan said, "I don't want either one. I want things the way they were. Leave me alone." So he didn't take an allotment. He also didn't move to the Caldwell Reservation. Wapato John, the merchant fellow from the Entiats group, decided this was a good deal. He knew a good deal when he saw it. And so he waited a few months, politely, because he was, after all, related through marriage to the Chelans. When they didn't take the property, he filed for all the choice land down around Manson and Chelan. And Wapato Point, which now has the casino and a lot of condos on it, is all still in his family. His son, Wapato Peter, who died in 1949, was pretty wealthy when he died. It's very interesting that originally the Chelans were pretty much dispossessed. They didn't get to keep much of their property, but the Entiats moved in and took it over through this process of allotment. Later on, after Yenemosetsa died, his son, Long Jim, as he was known, filed a suit saying that the Allotment Act was still valid and he could still go back and claim his allotment, and he did. And he took what is now the city park in Chelan and built a rodeo grounds and racetrack. And all through the early part of the 20th century, that racetrack was a focus of weekend activity. There were lots of races there. Horse racing was a big sport among the Native people, and the cowboys took to it too. So that was one of the big things around here, was to go racing at Long Jim's track. Now, as far as the white settlers that actually came into the Chelan Valley, that didn't start until 1886. Except for Camp Chelan, there were no settlements besides the native villages. There were a lot of different native villages. There was one at 25 Mile Creek where the bed and breakfast is. There was one at each of the two state parks, 25 Mile Creek State Park and Lake Chelan State Park. There were a whole string of them along the opposite shore, Manson through to Chelan. And there were villages on either side of the Chelan River, and there were villages down on the Columbia at the foot of Chelan Falls. So they were all through that area. What happened in 1886 was that the Lake Chelan was opened for settlement, and people started coming in. And the first settlers were two fellows named Sanders and Dumke, who came in from the Mihal Valley over the pass in a pack train. And their prize horse fell over a cliff while they were on the way. So they named the creek after their prize horse. His name was Prince. So that's how Prince Creek got its name. And Henry Dumke, when he settled in here, decided he would go up lake where there was good wood and start a sawmill. And so he picked a nice spot next to a beautiful waterfall, which is now called Dumke Falls. His sawmill didn't last for 2 or 3 years because a fellow named Wooden settled down at the foot of the lake and brought in a huge steam sawmill that had to be hauled up from the Columbia. And that became the industry that started Chelan. They built a logging camp at Stehekin and floated the logs down the lake to Chelan. And that was sort of the way things got started. How many of you drove in here from Wenatchee? And did you go over the Navarre Coulee?
I don't remember.
971?
Yeah. 970. Oh, 90 and 90.
Yeah. That's called the Navarre Coulee. And that was the first family to settle in Lake Chelan, the family of Ignatius Navarre, who was a civil engineer, and he did the first survey of the area, including that coulee and that route out of the lake. That's the story of the early settlement of Lake Chelan. That started the town of Chelan. As I said, later on in the 1890s, the Chelans themselves, the native people, were able to get property in the town of Chelan. And so, if you want to think of it, Manson is more of an Entiat village, and Chelan is sort of a Chelan village. And some descendants of them still live there and own property. Bill Evans, for example, is a grandson of Wapato John. No, he was grandson of Wapato Peter. Wapato Peter is considered the last Entiat chief. He died in 1949 at the age of 100. They were long-lived fellows. And Bill Evans still lives in Manson, and his family still controls much of the land there. Many of the developments there are on leased land because for a long time allotment land could not be sold, so they would lease it. I understand that in recent years they've gone to court and gotten the right to sell the land, but the family still own much of the property in that side of the lake. And that's all that's left of them. They have otherwise dispersed, and they have assimilated into the local economy. Whereas the Columbias, for example, most of them moved off to the Colville Reservation. The Colville Reservation is this mix of peoples from all over at least the north and eastern section of Washington. Some of them are Salish and some of them aren't. They're all different groups because they were moved in there. So that's the quick run through of how settlement came to this area. and how it affected the native people, essentially, it resulted in, as in most places, in them ending up on reservations, or either go to reserves or assimilate. That's what happened.
But most of the native people did not live up in valleys like this because
no.
There was no salmon.
They hunted up here, much more than coastal people. The coastal Salish people were beach people. They ate mostly seafood. Even their vegetable diet came from around the ocean. They ate a lot of seaweed, for example. Back in this area, the salmon were not as plentiful, and they hunted. They ate a lot of deer. They also hunted goats. They used the hides and the bone. They would, if necessary, eat the meat as well. So, probably, most likely Entiats would be hunting in this valley.
Where did you say the second main fishing place? One was the Salalah Isles, one on Leavenworth.
The other one is around Leavenworth. There are pictures of, there are a lot of rapids around Leavenworth,
yeah.
And they fish from the rapids. They even fished on the Chihuahua River, which comes into the Wenatchee River. Let me see if I can find it here. Here's Chumstick, and all in this stretch up here is where they apparently fished. This is the town of Plain. If you've ever gone that way around Leavenworth,
yeah.
Through Plain, it's this little valley up in here. There's Lake Wenatchee. The Chihuahua River comes up here, and it starts not too far from Holden. You can go up the valley here, across the pass, and into the Chihuahua River Valley. In fact, probably the one route that people took up the Entiat was over into the Chihuahua River and down to the fishery there.
Are there any dams burying these fishing grounds, or are they still here?
They're still there over there around Leavenworth. The Salilah Falls is underneath the reservoir behind the Dalles Dam now.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that when they fished, they had to use spears, nets, and weirs. So that weirs, they're sort of a fish box. They would put it in in between two rocks where a fish would go, and they'd run right into the box and couldn't get out again. They would have a kind of a trap door that they couldn't find their way out of again. Any other questions, sir?
This is very interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we've never known exactly what the local natives were like and what they did until this fellow wrote this book last year. And I guess it was just one of those details that escaped everybody's attention. For example, linguistically and in other ways, the people over here were identical to the Columbias over here. So if you look up the people, this region, they all talk about the Middle Columbias, or the people that were called the Columbias. Mm-hmm. And the language is called Middle Columbia Salish. So these people are sort of footnotes or details. And it took a local person, I think, to dig out the information and read all the old newspaper accounts and so forth. And there are really no people left who know the traditional stories, so they're all kind of secondhand accounts. A lot of it just handwritten things about so-and-so told me this story.